Welcome to
Tea O'Clock with Keller.
Bring your tea
and leave with more.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome back.
Welcome to our Shakespeare extravaganza, brought to you in two parts because we just have so much to say about it.
Yes. Very, very excited for this. And you'll be left on a cliffhanger, I'm sure, at the end of this episode.
Really. Yeah, I have to wait a whole another week.
And you have to wait a whole other week to hear our blonde moments as well. Oof.
Yeah. Crazy. And we're talking about the 2011 production.
Of All's Well That Ends Well.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for telling me what it is. Yeah. And this is available, once again, reminder, it's on Drama Online, which you can access via your institution.
Yeah, there'll definitely be a way for you to watch it if you're interested.
Yeah, but it turns out, and I did some research, I'm sure there must be other versions floating around online, because they did a 2022 version.
Did they?
Yeah, that was modernised. They did it actually in Stratford, I think. And I was reading, like, they did another one in 2013, there was another one in, like, 2018, which I was surprised, because when I was reading about it, it said that it's one of his lesser performed works, like, rarely performed, which is, like, fair enough. It isn't performed as much as Hamlet, for instance.
No.
They said that, and then I actually saw it had been done quite a few times in the last decade. So that, anyway, the point of that is there must be quite a few versions floating around. Like, maybe people will be able to get their hands on the Judi Dench version.
Yeah, it is interesting that people are like, oh, no one really knows or watches this, but there have been a handful.
Yeah, there have been quite a few.
I guess so. It's people love Shakespeare, don't they?
Yeah. Well, someone was saying online that it's more so one of the plays for Shakespeare's hardcore fans, but I don't necessarily think it is. Well, I understand what they mean, because it's not like your standard Romeo and Juliet, but I don't know. I think it's a lot more interesting than some of his other ones that I've read. So I don't know if you need to be a hardcore fan to enjoy it. I think it's got a wider audience than that.
No, definitely. And I think, I don't know whether maybe people think it's only for a hardcore audience of Shakespeare because it's less well known.
Yeah,
they and they're kind of put off by it because they don't know it. But actually, it's so easy to follow. It's a really entertaining story. It kind of subverts some kind of fun tropes, and there's some great, strong female characters.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's really good. I would highly recommend. And to think
me too.
Randomly picked it because we were like, let's pick one we haven't
done. Yeah. I can't believe you randomly picked it, and it actually turned out to be really, really good.
Yeah.
But first of all, on to our what we've been consuming.
Hey, Ella, what have you been consuming this week?
So I have been reading more children's literature this week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to mention Mallory Towers, which I read for the first time this week. Well, I read First Term at Mallory Towers by Enid Blyton, which I'd never read before. And Kerry and I have slightly different views, but I think that's because maybe Kerry's got some of the more nostalgia and whatever, but you can
type
up or whatever. It was interesting enough that I felt that some of the characters were a little bit kind of stereotyped or kind of stock characters, and it's set in a girls' school, and they have all their like disagreements and falling out, and they're all trying to kind of make friends and whatever, but I feel like all the problems are solved really quickly and really easily, and then they just forget about them and move on to the next problem, which I mean is entertaining enough for a child to read, but I think as an adult reading it, wasn't that invested, didn't enjoy it too much. But yeah, I think that's very much just because it's one of those children's books written for children, and obviously it's quite dated as well, from 1946. Even though there's not a lot of mention of like post-war England at all, it's kind of some ideal fantasy school. But I gave it 3 stars.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I disagree with you. I think I would still give it to children.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I wouldn't recommend it to adult readers.
Yeah, but I still, I think children are still, well, they obviously do still happily read it, and it is still taught, and there are still adaptations of it. There is a stage play, BBC adaptation. So, it's still fun.
Yeah.
Just a bit different coming at it as an adult for the first time. Watching... Oh, I watched a documentary the other night about Joan Didion called The Centre Will Not Hold.
Oh.
It's a 2017 documentary and it's available on Netflix, and it's produced, directed, everything by one of her nephews. And it was really interesting because I didn't know, or I still don't really know, a lot about her, apart from the fact that she was an incredible American writer, reporter, essayist. She helped to kind of shape and change writing with essay-style writing, and she wrote novels, and she did magazine columns and everything, and she worked with her husband a lot. It was a really interesting glimpse into her life, and it kind of tracked her writing career as such, and the things in her life that were happening that meant she wrote certain things, and different things in the world that she was influenced by. And it was really interesting. So I would highly recommend, if anyone like me doesn't really know much about Joan Didion, but I've heard her name kind of thrown around a lot.
Oh, definitely. She's one of those people where you definitely know the name.
Yeah. And it was really interesting. It was a nice kind of introduction to her. And I'm really interested to read some of her essays or novels now.
What made you watch it?
But I was just, last night, I just wanted to watch some form of documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to learn something.
Oh, that's nice.
So yeah, so I was just looking through the documentaries on Netflix, and I was like, oh, I don't know anything about Joan Didion. Let's watch that. And then listening-wise, I guess kind of in the spirit of, kind of accidentally in the spirit of Valentine's Day, but I think it's because it's around Valentine's Day that Spotify have made this playlist. But there's a playlist called Acoustic Love, which Aww. I've been really enjoying putting on in the background whilst I've been doing reading lately. And it's got some lovely songs that I know, but also songs that I don't know. And it's just nice and chill and happy. And it's not like overtly lovey and in your face. But it's just nice, kind of gentle, fun.
Aww.
So recommend that if you want a little bit of nice acoustic music in your life.
Aww. That is a good recommendation. I will have to listen to that when I'm reading.
Yeah, I do enjoy it. But obviously, if you're one of those people who can't listen to music with words whilst you're reading, don't try and read to it.
Bad.
Because it's like acoustic versions of songs with lyrics, but yeah, enjoying that. And that is me. Hey Kerry, what have you been consuming this week?
Watching wise, I watched A Room With A View, the 1985 film, and I didn't realise that they've done a 2007 version. Okay. Well, they did a version 2007, but I don't like the sound of it because I was reading up about the changes between the original book and the two adaptations, and they made it really PC, like the 2007 one, and all about Lucy being this strong woman, which is absolutely fine, but I really like the romantic element of it, which is absolutely what the 1985 version does. So I think that still has a lot of relevance to this day and still has an audience. So I really recommend, if you've not seen it, if you're a diehard fan of the book, I don't know that you would like the film because it erases a lot of Forster's social critique.
Mm-hmm.
But then I wonder, like, surely most people who've read the book have seen the film, so that might be redundant of me to say, but it's one of my favorite films, so I enjoyed watching that this week. And then for reading this week, I want to shout out I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, which you can find my little review on Goodreads by the link in our bio. And I did give it 3 stars, but I just keep thinking about it. It's right at the, like, not even at the forefront of my mind, it's right in the middle of it. There's all my thoughts swirling round and round. I just need someone else to read it, to talk about it with them. And my listening is related to that because I listened on the bus home today to a podcast called, let me check, Blue Stockings podcast. Anyway, there'll be the link to that. on our website. And I was listening to their episode about I Capture the Castle, because I just typed into podcasts, well, Spotify, looked in podcasts, I Capture the Castle, because I thought I need to hear someone talk about this. And it was three girls discussing it, and the first thing they said was justice for Stephen, and I completely agree with them, which means nothing to people who haven't read the book. But it was so lovely because it was like, it was just gave vibes of our podcast. And I loved that. It made me kind of miss going to uni to do English, because that's the vibe they were giving. They were doing a proper Englishy analysis of it, and I loved it because they were talking about things that I hadn't even considered when I was reading it. So that was so exciting, because it's more of a, like, I don't know if you class it as a children's book, but it, because it's a coming of age story, it does feel like, and it has a bit of a younger audience, and also because it's quite easy to read writing. So it was intriguing to hear the girls talk about it and how it's actually like a pretty cool modernist work. But I gave it 3 stars because, do you know what, I actually technically would reread it, but I was just frustrated by how it ended. So I don't know, maybe it deserves more because it got did have a big emotional response from me, but I wasn't happy with what happened.
Okay.
But I still think that everyone should read it, because it's so, I don't know, it just has something to it. It's really infuriating though, but I just basically want someone to read it so that we can chat about it.
Oh, okay. It's going on the list for
it's
sure.
It's kind of a romance, but it's also a family story, but it's not really romantic as such.
Interesting.
As you can tell, it's got its little finger twisted around me. That's not the right phrase.
I know what you mean, though.
Incoherent, because I was just processing a lot of strong emotions about it.
Yeah, I can. That's very interesting. Very cool.
Yeah, it is a quick read, too. I think I pretty much read it in a couple of days, which is always a plus. So that's me.
Let's summarise.
It's a problem play. Overall, it's supposed to be a comedy, but it's more so a dark comedy, and I don't even think it's that funny. Anyway, so Helena is the protagonist, strong female, let's go, and it's essentially about her being in love with this guy, Bertram. He doesn't love her back, and she manages to force him into marriage, and then he doesn't treat her very well and goes off to seduce other people in Italy. Oh, because it's in France. And then when he comes back, the king has a massive go at him, and they think Helena's dead as well. But surprise, she's not. And then when she reveals that she managed to get him to sleep with her without him knowing and get this ring off him, then all of a sudden he's like, okay, cool, I'll be your husband. It's fine.
And they live happily ever after.
Yeah, and there's also the Countess, Bertram's mum, is a big character, and she acts like a mum to Helena as well, and she's a really cool character. And then there's another plot about, how do you say his name, Paroles,
yeah, he's an interesting character.
Yeah, that's a subplot. He's Bertram's bestie, well, for lack of another word, which we'll get into. And there's a whole subplot about exposing him for being a coward, for not wanting to fight. So that's the gist of it, really.
That was a really good, succinct summary of the play. Oh, and I guess she manages to force Bertram to marry her because he goes and he uses her. He's orphaned, but he's been left some of her dad's medicine because he was some kind of healer of sorts, and she's able to use that to heal the king of France from his ailment. And then he's like, okay, you've cured me, so I will let you have my pick of men. And he picks Bertram, and he can't exactly say no to the king.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, and I suppose just to be super clear, the whole thing with Helena tricking Bertram into sleeping with her, that's referred to often by critics as the bed trick. And that is when, so he Bertram is especially trying to seduce this one woman in Florence called Diana.
Yeah.
And, well, because Helena becomes aware of this, she persuades Diana and her mum through a hell of a lot of money, 3,000 crowns, I think,
yeah,
to trick him into, like, so Diana says, right, come to my bedroom at midnight, don't talk to me.
Yeah.
That. Well, so because he doesn't talk, doesn't see, he doesn't, it's dark, he doesn't realise that actually he's sleeping with Helena when he wants to be sleeping with Diana.
Yeah.
So that's how that all pans out.
Yes, yes. And the bed trick was quite a commonly used trope and idea, and happened a lot.
Yeah, very disconcerting.
Very, very.
Did not age well at all.
No, and it's often actually used in quite a bit of gothic fiction. Mm. There's often a bit of a bed trick, kind of this in the same realm as cross-dressing and things within gothic fiction, kind of blurring the gender lines in that. But yeah, interesting. Mm. Interesting.
Did it give you, this is completely left field, but it reminded me instantly of Rocky Horror.
Do you mean just
with when Brad and Janet are in separate rooms, and then
with Rocky,
not Rocky, the Franken, whatever,
Frankenweenie.
Yeah, mad scientist guy, when he goes and convinces, manipulates both of them into having sex with him separately.
Yes, yes, I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of subversion of the bed trick.
I was thinking, because it's not exactly gothic, but if the gothic was done in the 1970s, then it kind of would be Rocky Horror. Yeah. So it just, it sprang to mind.
No, definitely, and I do think there is definitely that link there.
I was just thinking about how it's relevant to today, and obviously feminist discourses, which is going to come up a lot, but I just think this, it's this idea of manipulation, that's what still rings true, because I think with a lot of Shakespeare, perhaps people who are critical of it or who dislike it is because it seems very Elizabethan, which is fair, and not topical, and so I, as a Shakespeare fan, quite like to highlight things that I think are reasons why he endures, and I think that so the example of Rocky, this sexual manipulation, tale as old as time and still very much seen in works today, so that's just an interesting one of many comparisons that I'm sure we'll make throughout this big bonanza episode.
And I guess just quickly piggybacking off of that, I think another reason is the fact that it's a woman doing this, not the man. Because I think in a lot of Shakespeare plays, the men have all the control and are controlling and manipulating these situations. I guess the most obvious example would be Iago in Othello.
Oh,
with the handkerchief and everything manipulating Othello and everything. So I think it's also really interesting to see a woman doing that and taking control of her own life and her own marriage.
Absolutely.
And they do end up happily married in the end, which is nice, and no one dies.
True. Sure. You said so many things in there that prompted me to want to go off on so many different tangents, and I honestly don't know how to contain myself this episode because there's so much to get through, so many things I have to say. But for now, let's start with the central thing, your central theme that you raised, and that is that this is such a radically feminist play. So surprising. That's the first thing I text you. I was like, I can't believe how much agency the women have in this, and that it's actually more than just 2D. I saw someone on the internet called it paper thin female characters. It's absolutely not the case. I couldn't believe what I was reading. It starts with the Countess speaking. She's the first person to speak in Act One.
Because her husband has just died, and she is she's in control, and she's not being forced to marry someone else. She's allowed to be in control.
Yeah, and it's the women who are doing the scheming throughout. And I'm not necessarily saying that this is feminist in a positive way, but the women are conniving. I think there's a lot of, it's not black and white, the women are evil necessarily.
Yeah.
But I think it's incredible how three-dimensional the female characters are in this, and how much screen time they get, how many lines and how much power they have and influence over the course of the play. I've never read a Shakespeare play that is anywhere near as forward thinking in terms of feminism as this one especially, incredible. And so, you know, a lot of the women's actions in this can't really be justified, and it's not a question of whether the female character's actions are right or wrong in this, but I'm just saying, like, it just in terms of how radical it is, it's super, super interesting.
I 100% agree with that. I can't even think of another Shakespeare play which has feminine characters to this extent, and so central to driving the plot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, where to begin? I guess with Helena herself. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, right? How many plays do you have Shakespeare plays, where the female character is the protagonist? Yeah, you have huge central characters like Ophelia, but you don't have, I guess the closest you would come is like Juliet, maybe.
Yeah.
Desdemona. Yeah. But I mean, Helena just is the chief person in the play. She's like the Othello of the play, you know?
Yeah, because without her, none of these things would have happened.
It revolves around her, essentially. It's all about the character's relations to her.
To her, because they are all linked to her.
Mm.
Or have some link through others to her.
Yeah.
I mean, without her and without her science skills, the King of France would be dead.
Yeah.
I mean, even just that in itself is such a massive point.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing that really stood out to me was the entire concept of her choosing who she wanted to be married to.
So and all of them going along with it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So we still have, yes, it's conventional in terms of women aspiring to marriage, but I mean, come on, like, how radical can it be? Like, I think this is as radical as it gets at this point in time.
Definitely.
And for her to have all these men that she can choose from, especially when we know that she's from a lower class, lower rank, then she gets to not only pick which husband she'd like, but she also, you know, wins the king's favour. And all of this happens without the assistance of a man, of a husband. I mean, because, yeah, the king helps her, but that's more so because she's traded with him.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's why it's so impressive, is that everything that happens to her is her own making, all the success that she achieves.
Yeah, she hasn't had to give anything up or sacrifice any part of herself in order to kind of get what she wants,
yeah,
as such.
Like, especially even just having economic power, in that she can pay Diana and her mum to help her in her scheme with Bertram.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible. How does she even have the funds to do that?
Mm.
I mean, yeah, like, actually, where does she get that money from?
I wonder whether that comes from her marriage to Bertram.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking in that because, you know, the scene after they're married and she comes in with like a little tiara-y like head thing and a necklace and bracelets and her fancy ring and whatever. So, because obviously she does raise her station through marrying the Countess's son.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, that's where she gets the money from.
Okay.
I guess she was able to come up with this idea herself. Okay, yes, it is obviously manipulative and not great, but then again, Bertram, like, in her defense, Bertram marries her and is like, okay, we're gonna get married, but you're only gonna be a wife in name, and I'm gonna run away to war to get away from you. Like, that must be heartbreaking for her. Like, and she's always loved this man, and then he's just like, bye, I can't stand the look of you.
Yeah. Mm. Do you know what's really interesting is that there have been so many male protagonists throughout Shakespeare, so many that I can't even name them, that have done much worse than her, and there's not a debate in scholarship about
Yes.
You know, whether what they did was wrong, whereas so much scholarship that I, or like criticism that I looked over, it was all talking about how should Helena have done that, was it morally right, which is fair enough, but there's nothing about that with men. And I think, okay, yeah, like I also don't think that she should have done that, but I thought that pretty much most of the male characters, how they behave towards the females in the other plays, so I don't think that that should really be a central question of criticism. I don't understand, well, I understand why, because it's so subversive, isn't it? And it's interesting to think of the dynamic and how much power the man has in this situation. You know, Bertram, it's interesting that the role reversal and him not having a say in the marriage. But yeah, as I've said, you know, I think that she was very manipulative and shouldn't have married him. But I think, but my main point I'm getting at is that, like, regardless, why is it that this is such a big issue compared to, like, in, you know, in other plays?
Yeah, I think it goes right back to the age-old double standard for men and women. How women are meant to be these kind of quiet, obedient, you know, just doing what they're meant to. So as soon as there's a woman at the center of this play, doing everything in her power to essentially get her husband to be a husband in the way that he should. But no, it's definitely a double standard. Like you say, that all the criticism focuses on, oh, she's just this, like, maybe she's just this horrible, manipulative woman. And yeah, okay, she doesn't do great things, but she's not the only character in this play who doesn't do great things.
I don't think any of them are saints in this play. No. That were really great.
And I think that is representative of people in general on the whole throughout history. You don't have like saints and devils of people. People are grey. They fit into grey categories.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that these women are meant to be held to these moral standards. It's not expected of the men.
Yeah. And Julie,
that's an age-old debate, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not defending her behavior at all, but it's understandable why Helena behaves as she does, because the women are treated still, even with the powerful female characters in this, like the Countess, who's incredible, that's such a good role, dive more into that. The women are still treated so dismally in this play and ostracized so much, you know, like physically running away from Helena, but also with Diana being, you know, just she's a temptress as such, that's her role, and that's how she's viewed by the men, and then she's viewed as a liar in the court as well.
Yeah.
And initially when the king meets Helena, he thinks that she's a liar as well. And the women are more so reduced to like gossiping with each other as well. So I think, well, it's understandable, say, like, with when Bertram, he says he's going to sleep with, well, he thinks he slept with Diana and he promised to marry her, and obviously he doesn't, and you know, that's a big deal for the time. So I'm like, well, I understand why, like, you know, if she, if the roles had been reversed and Bertram could have picked a husband, I mean, well, a wife but also a husband, you know, like, he wouldn't have thought twice about it and picked whoever, and then the woman would have been expected to submit, like Juliet in Paris.
Yeah.
So I think, well, if, like, she has to do what she can, and, like, in a way, the character, the female characters have to act like the male characters in order to have any agency whatsoever. So I think, well, yeah, fair enough, that's what she did.
I think that's a really great way of putting it, the fact that the female characters have to act like the male characters in order to function and to have agency and to have the power in these situations.
Yeah, and it's a fault of the way that the patriarchal society is structured, because of how they've excluded women, they have to marry up to be able to have any say in anything, or have, you know, any relative success or station in life. So it's, you know, a fault of the system that these men have built, that, you know, she has to aspire to
marry Hoya, and at least she does it out of love.
Yeah, which I guess is a kind of redeeming quality to the fact that she is, I don't know whether that's the right way of saying it, but the fact that she's not doing this out of greed. She's doing this out of love. She's driven by her love for Bertram. And in the end, it's suggested that he reciprocates that.
Yeah. And I think that, say, if someone asked you one of those would you rather questions, and it's like, would you rather like marry the love of your life, but they don't necessarily want to marry you in the first place, or would you rather like not marry them and never be with them but see them be happy? I do think a surprising number of people would go for the first option and be like, you know what, yeah, I would kind of want to marry them, as awful as it is. I think, like, and we know as humans that it's awful, but there's some temptation that you kind of think, do you want to, you'd never really want to force someone, but I think based with playing on the idea that sometimes you just do whatever you can to be with the person that you love.
Yeah, definitely. And you see her doing this throughout this entire play. She's doing everything in her power to be able to be with the person she loves most.
Yeah, which again, you know,
even when that means she does questionable things.
Questionable, but it's questionable, but it's understandable.
Yes. And I feel like if the genders were reversed and it was a man doing everything he could to be with the woman he loved, I feel like we see lots of stories like that.
Yeah.
It shouldn't seem odd that we're seeing this type of story. It just maybe seems slightly more odd because the kind of genders are switched. And it's not kind of typical. We're not, as we were saying, back to the whole kind of women and agency and whatever, we're not as used to the women having, well, not as used to, aren't it, as many examples, and it's hard to within the patriarchal system to for these women to have agency and control over their situations.
You make a really good point there about if the roles were reversed once again with the gender. And I was just thinking that if the roles were reversed, that's essentially just continuing this story that is still told to men today of if you want to be with a woman, then you have to keep chasing her even if she says no. That's what so many even super modern rom-coms or like 90s noughties, that's the plot about, like, convincing this woman that she should go out with you. Even something I love, like 10 Things I Hate About You,
I was just thinking,
which actually it's Shakespeare. That's all about, like, constantly like trying to persuade this woman to be with you. So, you know, it makes sense why Helen is doing this. I think the role reversal, like, it would be a comedy, really, like a full-on, like, not even questionable comedy, but it then when it's a woman doing it, then that's like a tragedy.
Or even something like How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. And it's I do enjoy thinking about gender. It's really interesting to imagine if the gender was swapped, because I think that can highlight so many things that maybe you don't see otherwise. And I think it's a really interesting way of looking at how gender is kind of performed and presented to us in these different things.
I wonder if it would have been perceived as more of a comedy in terms of, again, I love to think about how in Shakespeare's time that all the roles would be played by men. So, like, that, which is super interesting to think of in terms of Twelfth Night as well.
In
this context, because they're watching a man chase after another man, contemporary audiences, would that make it a bit more farcical? If, you know, it kind of, you know, like a man doing all this like chase after another man, does that make it, you know, a bit more like considered as part of the comedy genre?
I think it would. And I read something in the introduction to this Arden Shakespeare version of it, which was saying how, I think partly that adds to the kind of problem, why it's one of his problem plays. But also the fact that it kind of flips this fairy tale story that people are so used to on its head, where it's the man being like, oh, you're the woman I'm going to marry and I'm going to do everything I can. It kind of flips that fairy tale story into giving the woman the power. And I do wonder whether that was slightly seen as a kind of ridiculed in kind of the Elizabethan times and seen as not serious, because how in the world would a woman have this much power? But I think that makes it seem very ahead of its time, mm-hmm. in a way that I definitely don't think anyone back then was conscious of or aware of. And I think that's why we were saying it still stands the test of time today, because it seems so modern and to be dealing with so many kind of modern issues and modern ideas that we're still looking at and trying to fix within media and the stories we tell today. So I think, yeah, whilst it might have been ridiculed, I don't know if ridiculed is the right way, but laughed at and seen as comedic, and that definitely being one of the comedy elements of the play, the same with the bed trick, I think that would have been seen as a very comedic, very funny element.
Yeah,
but it still translates really well to today. Yes, not in a comedy sense, but still in a way that the play and the story makes sense. And sorry, that was a very long ramble.
I don't worry about it, I've done a lot of them already. No, because you raised super interesting points there. That's made me think of something Isabel Allende said, which was that the way to say scary things or, you know, home truths, important things, make changes often through comedy, because it's less threatening and it comes off as almost like you're not really serious about what you're saying.
Yes.
It's more palatable, and that is exactly what's happening here. And so I can see how this was taken as more of a comedy back then, and I think also because it was less believable, which mm-hmm. I think is another thing you were getting at, that a woman could have that power. Like, it just seems more funny that, like, yeah, whatever, like, this isn't that tragic, because as if this would happen, whereas now we're like, yeah, this is totally feasible, so why is it funny? I do like the idea of this being a problem play, because I wonder what elements of it do make it a comedy. Is it what we've been talking about, that it would have been better perceived as a comedy at the time? Or I don't know, it's not at all like how with 12 Night and As You Like It, when there's a mistaken identities. Well, obviously there is in the bed trick, but, you know, it's not like constantly people disguising themselves, really. You know,
which is where a lot of the comedy in Shakespeare comes from, is from that disguise and that unsurety of who people are.
So how can it be a comedy otherwise?
I'm wondering whether potentially you get an element of that when Bertram and his mates, I can't remember what they're called, kidnap as such parolees. And are pretending. Give me what vibes?
Malvolio vibes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they're kind of trying to basically get out of him that he's a coward and didn't want to fight and doesn't really believe in the others. And I guess that uses a lot of dramatic irony for the audience, that they're able to see in the reactions of Bertram and the other. I feel bad that I can't remember their names, who they are in that
scene. Don't know. I mean, one of the main noblemen was called Lafayette.
Was he the old one? They kept making jokes about how he was old.
Yeah.
Lafayette, he's the old one.
Yeah, but the others were just like Lord One, Lord Two, so.
Yeah. So I'm just now looking at the character list, and there's the clown, and there's all those scenes with the countess and the clown.
A lot of thoughts about the clown, actually, that we'll get on to.
Yeah. But anyway, going back to that kind of comedy, I wonder whether there's a bit of a kind of dramatic irony comedy scene in that scene.
That's a good point. And I was reading an article about one of the more recent productions, or within the last 10 years, I think, and the critic was saying that the whole subplot with Broly that almost threatened to overtake the main plot. And I think that subplot was emphasized more, played up more, because without that it doesn't seem like a comedy, especially for a modern audience. That is interesting that in adapting it for a modern audience to maintain that comedy. Not that, I mean, in a way, how useful is it? Like, is it a bit outdated having these categories of tragedy and comedy? I don't know. Like, does it need to be categorized like problem play? You can make a case for a lot of plays, I reckon, being somewhat problematic. Well, in terms of actually being problematic and also like being a bit like not easy to categorize.
Yeah. I wonder whether that's maybe part of why it's not widely read or studied. Because I feel like definitely in kind of secondary school, they wouldn't pick a play like this because there are too many unanswered questions when it comes to this kind of genre stuff. So I think that's why they pick things like Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet and Twelfth Night and whatever, because I think they're maybe more concrete versions and examples of things. So I feel like maybe you'd only come to this one if you were like, say, a diehard Shakespeare fan, because it's one of those that kind of sits on a boundary.
Yeah. I think also because Shakespeare is often thought to not be that accessible.
Yeah.
And the general human desire to have things categorized.
Exactly.
Being a problem play makes it not as popular. It needs, I think, having a category, it goes a long way in making Shakespeare a lot more accessible for people. And I quite like the idea of the term problem play. I like categorizing them as tragedies and comedies, because I think having a problem really emphasizes Shakespeare being especially subversive. And I think categorizing something as a problem play highlights it being just a really interesting play in terms of genre and form.
Definitely.
And makes you consider in hindsight, I suppose, like maybe he didn't, like people wouldn't think this as such at the time, but now, like having these terms, I think it's useful for thinking about, okay, like what elements of comedy are in this, what elements of it are tragedy, like why do people tend to call it more comedy? Like, we've already been having this discussion about, like, okay, would this have been seen more as a comedy for a contemporary audience or a tragedy for a modern audience? And, you know, like, how do they interplay with each other? Like, is it, because I guess with a tragedy, is it more like that's a warning, that's the intention behind it, maybe, like,
you know,
be careful of like your hubris. But you know, what about this place? Like, I think it's just more nuanced, you know.
Definitely. I agree. And I think that's what makes it so fun and so interesting, that it doesn't just slot into one little box perfectly. It makes you think and question. And I think all the best pieces of literature and art and whatever do that, and I think that's the point. They shouldn't just be spoon feeding. I'm not saying that other Shakespeare plays do spoon feed you these things, because they don't. But I'm just saying this is one that's harder to do that.
Thank you for listening to part one of our Shakespeare extravaganza. We'll see you again next week for part two.
Thanks for listening to
Tea O'Clock with Keller.
See you next time.